Daniel, and here we go, another episode of We Talk Music on the air and in your ear. Once again, I am Martin, joined by the King of the Casters, Mr. Brett Podcast. Brett, we have a guest. I'm so happy to talk to you today.
Oh, for sure. I mean, honestly, we have been fans for so many years, and it is truly an honor. She's an amazing singer, an amazing performer. We have Ellen Foley on the show today. Ellen, so happy to have you on.
My pleasure, Brett. You're saying you've been a fan for so many years, but you seem too young to be aware of my entire oeuvre.
No, unfortunately, we just show it well. But honestly, since that very first moment of hearing Paradise by the Dashboard Light, and then thinking about how amazing your voice is, and just going and searching out your solo work and your music. It's just, so we've been following you for a long time, and it's, like I say, it's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So, right now, which is awesome, you have the new album coming out, Fighting Words, and the current new song is Are You Good Enough? A wonderful song. And so let's talk about Fighting Words.
Okay. What I love to talk about these days.
Well, let's talk first about, I guess, how it came together and just all the, the process of bringing it together as a whole, and why you chose to do another solo album right now.
It came together because I had been working with the composer, Paul Foglino, for several years. We did an album in, 2013 called About Time. So it was, it's been a pretty long relationship. I've probably known him for 15 years. And, he continued writing songs with me in mind. And the songs that he's written for this album are I think, a step forward from the last album in terms of how we know each other and, his comfort. His background is he was in a band called Five Chinese Brothers, and there was almost a folk slash Americana feel to it. And he's, very easily for this record, I think, really slipped into a rock and roll mode. And the way it happened, we made that record, we played gigs in New York mainly. We didn't travel with the band, but then I started traveling pretty regularly over in Europe, where I had a band over there, and was still like the Netherlands, Belgium, where I still had a pretty big following from my first album way back in the day, where was a number one hit, the song We Belong to the Night. Anyway, started going over there, and he was just here, writing these songs, and we spent a lot of time him playing me songs, me singing them, trying to get into the voice, rejecting some of the songs, and developing them. And it was kind of almost a 5-year process, because we didn't all go in, even pre-pandemic, we didn't all go in the studio together. He recorded the rhythm tracks. He sent the tracks to the rest of the band, keyboard, background singers, bass player, guitar player, and everybody put their own parts on. And then he brought it to me, and I put my vocals on top of all that in my living room. He had Pro Tools on his laptop, came into my living room, had a good mic. You can do this if you have a good microphone, which he did. And I think the result is pretty amazing. And I love doing it like that. It was really comfortable. You're relaxed. You don't feel pressure. You can try a lot of things. And he and I are pretty, what's the word I'm looking for? Not improvisational, but, he lets me go and take the direction I want to go, and either pulls me back or he comes with me. So that's pretty much the story of it.
How many vocal takes would you do on an average song, say?
Wow. because it was all spread out, that's hard to remember. You know, I've never been somebody who's had to do a lot of vocal takes. Paradise was done in one take. But that's when I was young and I didn't know to be worried about everything. So it was one take. We would do several takes. We would do, you know, as I think people do, you do a full take, you do a couple of them, you go back and you patch in or do parts, you know, just some lines, and then they'll have enough to work with in editing. But it's not like, you know, you're doing 30 takes. We can kind of crank it out relatively quickly. And the great thing is then, yeah, I would hear it. And if I wasn't happy or if he wasn't happy, he'd come back and do it again. So it could be spread over like it was, you know, a pretty decent period of time.
So then what are some of the tricks that you use to, like, you know, keep your voice in shape? And then as far as even like preparing to sing something like this, like how many times do you work on a song leading up to the song?
I still do a lot of vocalizing. I have recordings from my last vocal teacher that I have, but it, you know, to be perfectly honest, I'm the way a lot of people are, a lot of singers. You're too lazy, you don't sing. And then a month before you know, you have to go in the studio. You really, you know, you sing every day and you sing all the songs. And that's what I'm experiencing right now because I have something to do next week. So, I mean, the way I've been living the last 15, 16 months, I really haven't been singing. So I'm using this week or two to catch up for the last year and a half. But yeah, I never sing without warming up. I never sing without warming up. I come, I think, really prepared in terms of having worked on the song on my own and knowing it well and having it in my voice. Because you can, if you sing a song, you can hear where the tricky spots are. Because sometimes, you know, things don't always sit perfectly in your voice. So when you're on your own and, you know, the great, you know, technology that we have these days. I have my little speaker and I can blast it in my kitchen and just do this stuff, go along as you're living your life and just sing a lot, you know.
What was it then that drew you to Paul as a lyricist?
We did a musical together that he wrote the words and music. And there was just something so unique about him in that it came from an intellectual / anti-intellectual place. There was an irony to it. To me, there's a lot of humor to it. And so that's him as a lyricist, but you mean because he also writes the music. I always listen first to the melodies before I can even take in a lyric. But lucky for me, I love both his melodies and his words.
Yeah, because when you talk about going from Jim Steinman to working with, you know, Mick and Joe of The Clash, and now, you know, to Paul and stuff like that. I mean, you've worked with some amazing songwriters.
Don't forget Ian Hunter.
Ian Hunter, yeah, Ian Hunter,
right,
and Mick
don't
Ronson,
forget
right?
Ian Hunter.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's some amazing songwriters. So, I mean, you know, Paul's in great, you know, like great.
He's
company.
In great company. He is, but you know, he's not intimidated. I think people who are really talented, especially writers, live in their own little pod. So he's not looking to the right and left of him or behind his shoulder. I think he just he does what he does. I'm not saying he's overly confident because he's, you know, kind of a self-deprecating character, and I have to try to kick him out of that once in a while, you know, that you are worthwhile, you are, you know, worth love, that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I have had great fortune in terms of the people I've worked with. in, you know, in all the different areas of my career. That's for sure.
My favorite track is, well, I mean, I love, I'm just happy to be here. I think that's a, you know, just a terrific tune, but your version of Heaven Can Wait, I mean, that's just, it blows my mind to think that you were singing that in your living room. Your yeah. voice is so powerful and so good.
That one, no, there's a story that, I mean, if you listen to it, it's got a whole different sound from the rest mm-hmm. of the record. That was all actually done 10 years ago or so for a film I was in. Was called Lies I Told My Little Sister, an indie film. And the producer wanted me to sing it. It was under the closing credits. And we got permission from Jim. And she had a guy in LA. His name is Andrew Williams. He's actually Andy Williams' son. I don't know if you guys know who Andy Williams was. Yes. So he produced this. It's a very orchestral track, which is completely different than what the rest of the record sounds like, but it's just such a, it's a personal coda because that song means so much to me. And I like putting songs that I feel that are really touching and might touch people. I like putting them in the last track of the record, but thank you. Yes. I've sung that song for many years and
that makes sense to hear that it was, for the movie, that makes sense because it does have a different sound. And it's a significantly different version than the original as well. So how did the arrangement come about?
Well, I guess, you know, I sort of left, I'm assuming that, you know, I'm just trying to recollect what it was that he had heard my version, let's say live versions that they had. But when I did it live, there's a... into the bridge, there's a big build and a big drum step. And I know that I've been released, but he eliminated that. So the whole thing has a, like we said, a more orchestral, smoother feel to it. So that's the difference as far as I can see. And it was a little jarring to me because I would love that part where on stage because it's very, you know, pretty, it's balladic, and then it builds to this rock and roll moment.
Tell me about I'm Just Happy to Be Here then, because as I say, that's my other track that I just, is my go-to on the album.
And it's awesome that you're with Carla DeVito. I mean, that's amazing. So.
Yeah. I know. Well, the song came out of my friendship with Carla, because she and I didn't really know each other that well. And obviously there was a weird thing for me for many years because of the whole lip syncing situation. But, you know, that was her job. She had a job and that's just the way that worked out. But then we did a tribute to Jim 5 or 6 years ago. You can hear, I never know how many years ago it was. Time is in such a bizarre place. And it moves faster the older you get. So it's anyway, they put together a tribute of Jim's songs and Jim came and, you know, he wasn't well at that point, but he was really happy. And she and I just really started talking and clicked. And I said to Paul, I would like to have a song with Carla on the record. And I thought, you know, oh, it should be sort of autobiographical, you know, about the two of us, but he didn't go for that. You know, he wrote about people who had been through things in their lives, but not so literally, you know, so all that stuff we're singing applied to us just as, you know, grown up ladies who have had, you know, all these life experiences. And now, you know, that we're singing together and we're both in good places in our lives. So that's, I think, a really worthwhile thing to be able to sing about. I love it, you know, and I love the way it just bangs right into it. It goes, well, you know, I think that's so cool. You know, or my guitar player, Slim Simon, just so shines on this record, you know. Just, that's fantastic. Yeah, I'm just so happy with what he played on it. So great.
It's funny, you know, I get the feeling that you really love that rock and roll and that bombast and all of that. And you must be amazing on stage with those songs. But at the same time, my favorite album or my favorite song on the album is Fill Your Cup, which is the exact opposite.
That's great. I'm so happy you say that, because to me, and I've said this before, I think it's the most important song on the record because of the message it gives. Fill your cup. If you're lonely, insecure, come to me, sit at our table, fill your cup. Don't be ashamed. And I think that applies to everybody. And we've, you know, in this country, we had very rough 5 or 6 years there. I'd say 5 years, including the campaigning in 1915 or whatever that was. And things just got worse and worse. So it felt like the right song to sing, and it's really lovely to sing. Good for you that you like that best. Good for you, Brett.
Well, you know, it's like, I mean, that's the thing that I really like about the album too, is the fact that you go all over the place. I mean, that there is the little bit of country, you know, we've got that good rock and roll. I mean, we've got that E Street sound almost. I mean, it's just, we're taking it across the landscape of music, and I appreciate that so much.
Thank you. But I mean, that could be a negative, right? If some, you know, putting out a record that wasn't cohesive, but I think it is cohesive, even though it has different styles of songs.
Well, I think you're you're definitely the main piece of cohesion. I mean, your voice is your voice, and it absolutely ties it together, like from A to Z, you know.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. I think I like to think you're right. Thank you.
So now, one of the things, I mean, when you talk about, Jim Steinman is my favorite singer or favorite songwriter of all time. I mean, I actually do like him as a singer as well. But, you know, like, what was it like then, you know, to work with Jim? And then what's it like, you know, you doing Heaven Can Wait in this version? Like, what did Jim think of it?
Jim loved it, you know, because he cast me in a show that he wrote that we did at the Kennedy Center in 77, I guess. It was called Neverland, which, as you know, all his career and his records and the musical, the Bad Out of Hell musical, is all about these lost boys and lost children and hyper-sexualized and hyper-emotional life. So this show was called Neverland. You know, there were the lost boys in it. The villains were these killer nuns, these guys dressed up as nuns, you know, doing choreography. And I played Wendy. And Wendy, I mean, she was as Wendy is in Peter Pan, she was the virgin queen, the mother, you know, the all sweetness. But to sing Heaven Can Wait, I sang it in a white nightgown with blood down the front. So that's a rather, it doesn't take a lot to figure out what that meant. And, you know, and then Jim, I sang it then, and, you know, I've sang it always through the years. And I don't know if he said it was his favorite version, but, you know, he called me the Maria Callas of rock and roll. So I had to think that he loved the way I sang that along.
And of course, you know, working with Pandora's Box, Original Sin is my favorite song off of that one as well. I mean, just, you know, such amazing songs. And so cool that you got a chance to sing them, which blows me away.
Right. Yeah. It was really fun. Some great, you know, all female singers, which is so cool, because if anybody, you know, would say, you know, whoa, Meat Loaf, you know, and all the guys, and, you know, is there any misogyny involved? And then Jim turned around and made an album with all female singers because, you know, he loves the big voice and the range. So it made sense to have all the girls singing his songs.
Well, I mean, there's a certain way the songs are crafted. They've always been made that way. They're made that way now. They'll be that way in the future. And Jim Steinman threw all that out the window, didn't he? I mean, when
yes.
he saw the lyrics to, you know, Paradise on Dashboard Lights, I mean, I can only imagine, I would have thought to myself, what is this? This isn't how you write songs. This isn't going to work.
Yeah, why do you have baseball?
And the baseball, in the baseball. He just put everything that he loved. He loved, you know, Americana and you know, the teen, the romance, the teen, you know, sex. And the only thing that wasn't in that record was a surf analogies, you know, because I don't think Steinman was ever in the Pacific Ocean, but, you know, he loved the Beach Boys and, you know, he, you know, loved the surfer culture. But, you know, and to have Phil Rizzuto, he loved, you know, baseball. So he had the luxury of putting all the things that he ever loved into that song. And in terms of me saying, like, well, this isn't how you're supposed to. What did I know? I had never sung on a record before. I didn't
Good
know.
Point.
I just thought, wow, this is too great. This is fantastic.
I'll do it.
You want me? Sure, I'll sing this song.
Do you remember the first time that you heard it on the radio, where you were?
I do. I was, because in between making the Meatloaf record and when it came out, I had done my first album and I did a lot of promotion. Then I did shows in Europe, you know, I toured and I came home. It was a late night flight and I heard it in a taxi coming back from the airport from JFK. And I was almost to my apartment on the Upper West Side. And there I was, and, you know, and I say to the driver, that's me singing. And, you know, I don't think he believed me. He said, I have some psycho girl in my back seat. But that was the first time I heard it. Yeah.
Wow. That's a good story.
For sure. What's the story behind Ellen Funky?
I don't, you know, Steinman gave everybody nicknames and knew he's, ooh, Funky, you know, because Foley, Funky, I don't know, it just came, I don't think he thought I was a particularly funky person, because I'm not, in any, you know, the different definitions of funky, it's just, you know, it felt right, you know, in his mouth, I suppose. Ellen Funky.
So then when it comes to, I mean, the fact that you've been in movies and TV and on the stage, of course, singer, like, is one of them your favorite to perform in, or are they all kind of equal?
I would say being on stage with a band is my favorite because, you know, you can control it yourself. It's, I managed to develop, I think, really good taste in song choices. And in finding bands and in finding musicians. And I just, you know, I love to play that character. It's kind of outside of who I am in real life. So to get up there and just, you know, pretend I'm Mick Jagger is really fun. I've been doing this for so long and I'm obviously Ellen Foley, but somehow in the back of my head, I think I'm still that 14-year-old who saw Mick Jagger on stage in St. Louis on the Rolling Stones' first tour. And I said, I want to be that guy. You know, so I think that's still in the back of my head. I want to be Mick Jagger when I grow up.
Everybody wants to be Mick Jagger when they grow up.
I know.
Yeah.
There
yeah,
are absolutely. Millions of Mick Jaggers, with one of these walking around, huh?
Some of us do it better than others, like yourself.
Yeah. Thank you.
So then, go ahead.
No, I'm just wondering: is there any live performances planned in support of the album?
I am going to go back over to Europe in January. I was supposed to go two springs ago in April of 2020. Then I was supposed to go this past spring, and you know, there was no travel. So it's set up that I'm going to do that. At this point, that's sort of all there is, except there's a live stream that happens at a place here called the Bowery Ballroom. And so Randy Haker, my publicist, is trying to work out with them to do a live stream in September or something, which would be fantastic to play this album and to sort of coincide with its release. So I'm really hoping that's going to be happening. If not, I want to put together a band and do a gig or a few in the city. Mm-hmm. So I hope to. It's mm-hmm. a long story. Yeah.
How many then, you know, so, you know, you take this album, but then you go back to your other albums. Like, what would a set list from you look like at this point?
Well, because I perform, you know, mainly over there. So there would be a number, you know, there would be We Belong to the Night, What's the Matter, Baby, Stupid Girl. I would do some really cool covers, stuff off the last album, because it was around that time. God, I haven't been up there for so long, but I would say it was weighed heavily on the Ron Sinhunter album. There was a lot of that.
So then, you know, when you work with all these different people, like is there similarities between them that all kind of tie them together, despite obviously being very different people?
Well, I guess they wanted to work with me.
Which makes
sense.
Like
me. Yeah. They really like me. That was the first thing. All these people, you know, were just really, you think about Hunter and Ronson, where, you know, came from that just really authentic. I think everybody who I've worked with are super authentic in what they do. Hunter and Ronson, the guys in The Clash, I mean, they really just created themselves. So to be around people like that was pretty cool. And Paul is absolutely authentic. You know, there's no artifice or pretense about him. And then Steinman was Steinman, and Meat. You know, he's a lot of things, but phony is not one of them.
You must have been one of the first people, because I mean, I know everybody has the same reaction when they see Meatloaf for the first time. It's they form an opinion, and then they hear him sing, and a new opinion happens. You must be one of the very first to have that experience.
Well, I met him before I heard him sing. You know, I knew him very well.
Okay.
Because we had been on tour in this show called the National Lampoon Show. I think we came up to Canada. Yeah, we did some shows up there. The National Lampoon Show, which was a satiric review, basically, did different sketches, and Meatloaf was in it, and Jim came along. He was the musical director. So I knew Meat for like a couple of years before we got into the studio. So it didn't work that way with me. It wasn't like, how do you do? I'm Meatloaf. Well, hello, I'm Ellen. Let's sing this song. There was a long relationship there.
Were you aware that he was a singer?
Well, yeah, because we sang, there was singing in the show.
Oh, they're singing in the show. Okay.
Yeah.
It makes sense if Jim Steinman's there.
Yeah. Jim was there, you know, being his one man band, pounding away on the keyboard. And at that time, I mean, he was there because he and Meat had a relationship, and they had started to work on the record, you know, Jim was starting to write for the record. And then Meat got tired into this show where he was going to be traveling and said, Jim, why don't you come along? And so he was in the middle of creating this stuff, and I was there, and just I was in the right place at the right time.
It's a nice place to be, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know who you remind me of when you laugh, Brett, who's also a Canadian, is Seth Rogen.
Oh, your laugh. Interesting.
You know, you hear him, you know, he laughs a lot because he's high all the time. I mean, maybe is your situation or not. I don't know. But when you laugh, you kind of sound like him.
All right, yeah, not high. So.
Not
you do sound like, you know, I've never thought of it before. You do sound like that, Brett.
Oh, all
he
right.
does. Wow. He does.
He does.
Learn something new every day.
There you go. And your voice, too, the way he speaks, too, a little bit, right?
Oh, he's from Vancouver, so it's not too far from here.
Exactly.
So then when it comes to the new album, like what kind of, you know, I guess, are you planning on doing any music videos? Or are you planning on doing anything else to really pump it up?
Well, Carla and I are talking about possibly doing some sort of video for I'm Just Happy to Be Here, which I'm going to call her after we get off the phone. I mean, it would be like she's in Oregon, I'm here, but, you know, maybe we should give it a shot. I think that would be a fun thing to have on YouTube. You know, yeah. people would find the song because they would obviously see the YouTube video. So I think that might happen. That could happen.
It totally should happen. You know, in my opinion, it should happen. And really okay. needs to happen. Let's make this happen because.
All right. Now you've inspired me because every day I'm like, oh, I should call Carla. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to. So, but now I'm going to say that I've been coerced by Brett into calling you. So he said, we have to do this. So let's go.
That's right, because you know it only seems well. Because honestly, just the seeing you two together and on YouTube in the video, that's I think that's what everybody needs.
Okay.
You know, when it comes to, you know, of course, also the new album. Like, did you guide Paul a little bit towards the style that works best for you?
You know, it's like the guidance or just the natural thing that comes about. I think that he knew probably from our previous experiences together what didn't work for me. And, you know, he learned from that. And like I think I said in the beginning of the interview, he brought songs and there were definitely things I said, no, didn't work for me. So, I guess in that sense, I did guide him.
And then, wow, what made you choose I Found a Love?
That was a Paul. That was a Paul suggestion when we were playing live, working with the band, because it's a super song to sing live. It's got that, you know, R&B, you know, James Brown, obviously Wilson Pickett kind of vibe. If I could, I would be down on my knees and they would bring me an ermine cape and help me off stage, you know, like James Brown. But I can't, so I don't. And so that, you know, having something that you've sung live and it works really well was a good enough reason to put it on the record, I think. And it came out so well.
I mean, once again, I would love to see you in a show with the cape and, you know, shrugging that off. I think that would be a fantastic visual.
I really think we should work it out. I mean, of course, Paul makes fun of me. He says instead of the cape, it should be, like a little raincoat and the little plastic hat that old ladies wear in the rain. And my little handbag, and they help me off the stage. So that's funny.
Yeah, I mean it makes us laugh, but at the same time, I mean, I know you're just being silly, so.
No, it was funny.
We've had an amazing time talking to you. And before we let you go, so that you can call Carla, so that you can set up a video. But before we do that, then we want to give you the chance to tell everybody how they can keep up with you, where they can find Fighting Words, and just everything Ellen Foley.
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. The record will be out on all streaming platforms on August 6th through Bandcamp and all that good stuff.
Maybe Carla's phoning you.
That's what I was thinking.
No, I'm sorry. It's one of those phony calls. It's from Greenville, South Carolina. I don't know if you get all those calls. You know, I get calls from Mozambique. You know, they say they're calling from.
Yeah, we get
sorry about that.
All good. No problem.
Okay, you guys, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Like I say, it's been a true honor. I urge everybody to go out and listen to Fighting Words. Wonderful album, wonderful singer. Ellen Foley, it's been a pleasure, and we wish you nothing but the best.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, and we'll look for that video.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Dedicated to Brett and his laugh.
Okay. Yes. And he's not stoned.
Not stoned at all. Nope.
Not stoned at all. Bye, guys.
Oh, he says.
Bye now.
So he says. Bye.
Yeah. Bye.
I don't care about the hearts that you used to break. I don't care about the drugs that you used to take. I don't wanna hear your stories all about your life for crap. Don't waste my time. I know that you'll do good. I'd fix you if I could. But what I care about, what I can't do without, just let me say, are you good enough at loving me? I don't care about the lessons that you learn. You burned. I don't care how many steps you covered in recovery. That don't matter to me.